Are we on? While everybody's doing that, just wanted to say my thank you to everybody for all the work behind the scenes and for coming and being with us from however near or far. It is a wonderful thing for the family to get together. You know, as I was listening to the prayer requests, it reminded me, and I think it's the good stage or setting for what I want to cover today, but we too many times forget that we're at war. We have an enemy, and when you look at the world that is out there and what is going on in the world, we are at war. And so many times when we look at what's going on in our daily lives, I don't think many of us really take it in the context of that there's an enemy trying to steal our joy, to kill our hope, in effect, to murder us because he's jealous of who we are. And the reality is, we're under attack. I think if we were to start at the front and work our way around, that you would find almost every single individual, or at least every single family, is fighting something. Whether it's discouragement, whether it's health or finances, or the job, issues with children, or what we're going to talk about today is marriage. This day was set up to be about parenting and marriage, because when you think about it, what is the basic nuclear unit that God wants everything to start from? And it's the family unit. And if you go back, let me stop there for a second. What I want to try and get through today is that our Father places enormous value on the institution of marriage. I'm going to talk today and maybe be blunt at times, maybe metal at times, but I will not apologize for the word. This isn't intended to make anybody feel bad or discouraged or hopeless or helpless. You are where you are. Your past is your past. The only thing you can deal with going forward is the future. It's how you choose to respond, how you choose to make decisions from now on. We can't do anything about what's been done already. So I don't want anyone to feel bad if I talk about certain topics and that happens to have been your circumstance. It's not to pick on you, it's to say, here's what the Word says, and here's what we can do about it, and here's how we can go forward. But the whole point, the context, is that God, our Father, places enormous value on marriage. It is the building block of the life that we live. I want to remind you that it was created at the beginning, and I guess for time's sake, some of this I'm going to just refer to, but remember when the days go by and every time that God created something, and at the end of the day, and he said, and it was good. Good, good, good. And you get to day six, and all the animals are created, and then he creates Adam, and he says, it's not good that man would be alone. And so he starts off on day six after he does all these things, and he says, you know, something's missing. This is not good. I can't make that statement, so we know the fact that he put Adam into a sleep and took the rib out and he fashioned the woman and brought her to him, and he just goes, wow, wow, wow. And then God said, and a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife. And then it ends, they were both naked and unashamed. And so in that initial creation of marriage, right at the beginning, on day six or somewhere there, depends on how you want to interpret how the verse is written, he said, it's not good. And then he made woman, and he said, it was good. And the verse that my wife and I talk about a lot is that they were naked and unashamed. They were completely vulnerable. They were, in effect, totally exposed, and it was okay. That's how we were created to be. And so that, I think, is the goal that we have in our lives for those who want to get married, for those who are married. Regardless of what you would classify your marriage, is that the intent was that we could be completely open and honest and vulnerable, that we could be, as it were, naked and unashamed. We can say, we can go back, that marriage was part of the original creation process. It is something that was designed for mankind at the beginning. It is not a cultural activity. It is not something that today we get to choose what marriage is. It is something that started at the beginning when the Creator said, it is a man and a woman, and they are going to be the married unit. And from them, from that union, they will reproduce, they will go out and multiply, and they will fill the earth, they will subdue the earth, and my plan will be fulfilled. And so for all of us, we need to remember, I think, one, the value that our Father places on marriage, and that it is something that is not cultural, it is scriptural, it is biblical, it was at the beginning. I'd like to cover 3 points today, just to paint a picture. And seems like over the past several months, I've given a number of sermons and an aspect on marriage. And today is a little different one, but I do want to touch base on a couple of areas that I guess I just want to share some of the things that have been going on in my mind. I don't mean to say I have all the answers. Sometimes I don't even have the questions. But if we look at marriage in the context that it is also under attack. It is also under attack. And so that it doesn't excuse our behavior, but it helps us understand the context. That we are at war, and in some cases the war is going on from outside forces. I mean, Ephesians 6 is so powerful, and I'm going to keep referring that our battle is not against flesh and blood. It is not. That's what we're told. And so, too often, I think we forget what's going on there. But let's turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Just to read a few verses here. Ephesians 5. And I'm going to start in verse 25 because Paul actually spends more than twice as much time talking to the men than he does to the women. So I'll try and spend a little time. Women, you're not going to be off the hook. But the point I want to get across is, do we look at our marriage and do we understand that marriage is intended to picture Christ and the church? We're going to read. Those are the words that are written. That there is something within the institution of marriage that is to help us to understand what is going on between our Messiah and the body of believers. And in verse 25, I'm reading from the New Revised Standard Version. It says, husbands, love your wives. And then there's a qualifier. Just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. The singing that we did, the discussion that we have, we are so thankful that we have a Savior who said, I will die for you. And that's the only way we would be saved. I don't know any other way that we can be saved except that that was the sacrifice that he made. And so the instruction is, men, love your wives just as. He doesn't say, lord it over your wives, belittle your wives, dominate your wives, all the things that, through the history of mankind, that's still going on in the world, and sometimes in the history of believers. Because too often we think the word submit means something that it doesn't mean, and authority means something that it doesn't mean, and headship means something that it doesn't mean. But we're instructed right here, it's very clear. Husbands, love, that's an imperative. It's not a, if you think about it, if you're feeling good, it says love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. He was a total sacrifice, the ultimate. He was willing, and he did die for the church. And that's the attitude that we are to approach our marriages. There's a statement that I've used a lot here locally, so our regular people, forgive me, but I firmly believe, and I think I can prove to you, that God is more concerned with our holiness than our happiness. So it isn't about if you're happy, it's this is an instruction for you as a husband to love your wife just like your Messiah loved the church. He was willing, and he did. He died for her. And why? In order, this is speaking about us, all of us sitting here, why did he do that? In order to make her holy, to be distinct, to be separate, to be set apart. That's what holy means. He said, in order to set her apart with the washing of water by the word, so as to present the church to himself in splendor. This is going to be magnificent, what I am doing, and I died for, so that it would be a purification and a holiness without spot or wrinkle or anything of the kind, yes, that she may be holy and without blemish. That is what he is doing. That's what he did. That's his purpose and intent, that he is setting apart something very precious and distinct and separate, and he's going to make sure there's no spot and there's no wrinkle. And we're told, in the same way, verse 28, husbands should love their wives as they do their own bodies. If I were looking in the mirror, I'd be saying it to myself, but I'm looking at you. Some of you guys out there look like you really love your bodies. Take pretty good care of it. Well fed, if you get my drift. But not joking around, we are experts in self-care. We are experts in self-care, and yet we are told to love our wives in the same way, the same attitude, the same focus, the same energy, the same purpose that we take care of ourselves. This is what he's saying. Marriage is supposed to be a picture of what our Messiah is doing for us, and too many times it's just all about me. It's all about me. But in verse 28, it says, in the same way, husbands should love their wives as they do their own bodies. For no one ever hates his own body, but he nourishes and tenderly cares for it, just as Christ does for the church, because we are members of his body. We're part. We made the commitment. He's committed to us. I'm going to talk about commitment in a minute, but the point is, if you're married, you made the commitment. You said, this is the one for me, and we're committed to it. And he's committed to us. And it says in verse 31, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is what we read would have read if we would have gone back to Genesis 2. These are the exact words from the beginning that the two will become one. And if we as men, as husbands, if we have the sacrificial attitude, if we have the sacrificial love, if we have the desire that we are trying to emulate our King, if we are trying to be like Him, then we are going to give sacrificially, and we are going to take very, very good care of that bride of ours. Now, after he gets done telling us that the two will become one flesh, he says, this is a great mystery, not how a husband and wife become one, but he says, I'm applying it to Christ and the church. What we do physically, how two come together, and really what I think it means is that if you are one flesh, that whatever happens to you cannot but affect what happens to your wife. That you are so intertwined that what happens to one affects the other. When she's down, you're down. When you're up, she's up. You function as a unit. And there were no kids involved in the first unit. So it's the husband and wife. It's not about having kids. It's about becoming one. So that whatever happens to me affects Sharon. Whatever happens to my wife Sharon affects me. When we become one, it's even the whole issue. I'm going to go back to Genesis. It says, I will make you a helpmeet for her. If you really get into the Hebrew, it means a completer. That man is not complete socially or emotionally or spiritually or maybe even physically without that woman. And he says, when you have her, it is a one nice unit package, but you got to have her. And so what we're being told is, if you could just see what I'm doing in your physical bodies, you'll have somewhat of a grasp of what it's going to be like when we're spiritual. And he says, it's a great mystery. And there's some things I say I don't understand well enough to explain. And maybe that's what Paul's telling us, that, you know, maybe he's saying you're not ready for it, so just accept that then a miracle occurs and think about your marriage. And that's how it is. And then he concludes this section for husbands and wives. He says, each of you. Now he gives the responsibility back to each of us. And I would strongly encourage you, if you've not read the book or watched the DVDs or attended one of the sessions or the seminars, Emerson and Sarah Eggerich have a book in a series called Love and Respect. Guess where they get it? Right here. Because it's a fundamental principle from the Father that husbands who do not love well, we're told starting off in verse 1, guys, love your wife. We're told in this verse here, verse 33, each of you, however, should love his wife as himself. Men, love your wife like you love yourself. And a wife should respect her husband. We can give, and I have given, a whole nother message just on love and respect. They are obligations to both parties without asterisks. Only if she's loving. Only if she makes me love her. Only if I feel like loving her. Only if it is an instruction to love. And we're going to talk about what it means to love in just a couple minutes. And the women are told, you are to respect your husband. Some women say, well, what if I don't think he deserves my respect? That's not what it says. You are to respect a man. I think if you study into the topic, if you look into the principles, you will be astounded at the power of this verse. Actually, there's whole seminars and books and DVDs. They're excellent. Emerson Eggerich, Love and Respect. So the first point I want, after the fact that God places enormous value, is that it pictures when we become one, when husbands love their wives, when wives respect their husband, it pictures what is this mystery of how it's going to be with Christ in the church. And you know what's really interesting in my experience growing up in the faith and learning and having to change and hopefully maturing? That by doing, a lot of times you develop understanding. When men, and this is a principle we'll cover later, loving actions create loving feelings. It's not, well, when I feel like it, then I'll do it. It's you do loving things, then you will have loving feelings. Let's go to point number 2. Marriage is intended to be permanent. There's some fabulous examples of that commitment in this room. If I may pick on you, 60 years. 61 years just sitting right there. There's lots of examples. I feel like a babe talking about it, and I've only been married 31 years, so forgive me, I've got still a lot to learn about marriage. But the reality is, it was intended to be permanent. It is a covenant relationship. You know, it's interesting when you look back at all the covenants that God has made with mankind. I still think they're in effect. Even the one he made with Noah is in effect. You know, I still see a rainbow out there. That in your descendants all the earth will be blessed through circumcision. I mean, there's all these covenants that I feel are still in effect. And yet, I think I've been involved in 10 marriages myself where I've performed the marriage. And every one of those couples has said, till death do we part. And guess what? Some of them didn't live up to that commitment. 2 out of 10. Statistically, though, over 50% of all those who say I do, including those who profess to be disciples of Jesus Christ. I can't make a broad brush statement here, but if you include all those who claim that they are either born again or baptized or whatever, the statistics within the churches at times exceed the secular society, because a lot of times people just live together, they don't get married. So the reality is, what goes wrong? Why isn't it permanent, even though out of our very lips many people said, till death do us part? Now I am going to put an asterisk. There is no place in any marriage for abuse, for violence, emotional, physical, sexual. There are some things that I believe are deal breakers. There's no place in marriage for somebody to be abused. But other than that asterisk, the issue is why. Let's go back to Malachi chapter 2. Malachi chapter 2. I quote this verse a lot, but in a different context. Usually when I'm talking about the verse, well, let me just read these verses. We'll read a bunch of them first. Let's start in verse 13. The context is that the people were being unfaithful to God. They were giving him lip service. They said they were committed. They said they would give things at the altar. They said they'd give things at the temple. But the bottom line was, they did what they wanted. They were giving God lip service. It says, in this you do as well. You cover, verse 13, you cover the eternal's altar with tears, with weeping and groaning, because he no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor at your hand. You ask, why doesn't he? They're trying to blame God. Look, I brought my offering to the altar. Why isn't it you aren't hearing my prayers? Why isn't you aren't... What's wrong with you? They're saying, I'm doing my job. But behind the scenes, they're doing anything they want. That as long as they went to the temple, as long as they gave an offering, they could go live any kind of life they wanted. They could sin. And the priests were not enforcing it. And they're wondering, what's wrong with me? Why isn't my prayer being heard? And so they're asking this question. Continuing on, you ask, why does he not? Because the Lord was a witness between... Wait a second. Guess what he brings up? The nation is suffering. The people are suffering. Things are going on, and they're saying, what's the problem? And guess what he says? Because the Eternal was a witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. He's saying, look what you're doing in your marriages. Because, you know, back in that society, it was all about men dominating society. And a lot of those men were divorcing their wives so that they could marry women from another culture who worshipped a different god. And they were taking the wife that they had been bound to and casting her away because they wanted some newer model. I mean, that sound familiar? Verse 15, did not one God make her? Both flesh and spirit are his. What he's really saying, do you understand that this is my daughter? that I created her and that she's really important to me and how you treat her matters to me? Didn't he make her? That's the question. Didn't God make this woman? And what does the one God, the eternal, desire? What does he desire? Godly offspring. Now, you know, a lot of times I talk to parents and say, you know, God doesn't want offspring. He wants godly offspring. But in another context, he's talking about us. He wants us to act like his children. Not children of the world, but his children. He wants us not to be just people. He wants us to be godly offspring. He's talking at one level to us. Do we reflect? Are we being conformed to the image of his son? Are we truly trying to be in the likeness and image of God? So look to yourselves, and he says, and do not let anyone be faithless to the wife of his youth. You know what's interesting there is he's saying, do you have the same commitment to your marriage as that I do to you? God is faithful, right? We say that. He's steadfast. He's unchanging. We can count on him. He's not fickle. I change not, same yesterday, today, and forever of Jesus Christ. It's like he is a known quantity, and he's faithful, and he's committed, and he's saying, why can't you treat your wife that way, guys? And then in verse 16, he says, for I hate divorce, says the Eternal, the God of Israel, and covering one's garment with violence, says the Eternal of hosts. So take heed to yourselves and do not be faithless. It's pretty clear, if you ask me, what his attitude is about marriage, about the role of a man and a wife. And it is supposed to be a covenant, we read. It's supposed to be permanent, we read. And by the way, he says, I hate it. I know from experience that when God says he hates something, I try and pay attention to what he says. And again, I'm not picking on someone. If you've been divorced, we can't go do anything about that. But what we can do is, how are you going to live your life now? How are you going to live your life from now on? So that's point two. Do we have the same commitment to marriage as God has to the promises to his people? They are unchanging. They are permanent. He is faithful. Do we understand how important this institution is to him? Let's go to point three. Talked about it, pictures Christ in the church. It's intended to be permanent. It's a covenant, and God hates divorce. We are told to love one another. That's a requirement within marriage, to love one another. You know, loving is not an option if you are a believer. It's not an option. There is no way out. If you claim to be a believer, if you claim to be converted, if you claim to be baptized, if you claim to be whatever you say you are, then you have no option but to love. We're going to read some verses that a lot of people are really good at saying, but that is talking to us amongst ourselves. I'm going to say, yeah, it does. But I think it really applies to us amongst our spouses. Let's go to 1 John. Actually, I'm going to go to 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4. The context is, the heading of my chapter says, continue to love each other in the midst of suffering. If you look at the world that's going on around us, and believe that we're under attack and that we're at war and things are falling apart and we're down the downhill slide, all the whatever descriptors you want to use, I think we're going to start seeing the increase in suffering. Because there are verses that talk about the process of developing character and hope and belief. And a lot of it is because he suffered, we're going to suffer. We're not immune from what our example is set for us. So that's the big context. But in verse 8 and 9, I want to apply this, ask you to apply this to your spouse. And if you're not married, then apply it to your brother or to your sister or to your neighbor. But it says in verse 8, above all. Not that I am expert in the English language, but when something is above all, that means it's like above all. It's the top. Maintain constant love for one another, for love covers a multitude of sins. How many times do we apply that to our spouse? Well, rascal. I can't believe. Why did I end up with her? Or the problem is you're going through this with your spouse and somebody comes to the door and you are the nicest, most pleasant, most cooperative, friendliest guy to the neighbor you can't stand. And yet you'll turn right around and the door is shut and go right back hammering your spouse. It says, above all, maintain constant love for one another, for love covers a multitude of sins, because God is love. And when we demonstrate love, he says, you know what? You're getting it. You're getting it. You're starting to become just like me. And you know what? I can overlook some of the stuff because you're getting it. And it will cover. Then we still have to ask forgiveness. We're going to apply the blood, but it covers. That's what a lot of all the Old Testament sacrifices, right? They were covering. It's like, I don't see him anymore. On Day of Atonement, they were done away with. But love, it says, covers a multitude of sins. So if we start focusing on love, and I don't want to get into the issues of commandment keeping, and all, those are fundamental, basic things that if we're not doing the fundamentals, then we're not getting it. But it's all about love. Love, put, instead of one another, put to your spouse. Maintain constant love for your spouse, for the love of your spouse will cover a multitude of sins. I don't think that's a wrong use of applying that verse. Verse 9, be hospitable to one another without complaining. Ever done any complaining in your house? Being hospitable, good-natured, willing to serve. I think that's what I've seen many, many fabulous examples of hospitable brethren. They go out of their way to make your visit with them a delight, a pleasure, a joy. They're hospitable. Why can't we do that to our spouse? You know, I think back of the verses when it says become one flesh, and we're asked, we're told, you love yourself a lot, you always take care of your own flesh. But we're told to love our neighbor as ourself. Do you consider your spouse yourself a neighbor? Go back to the Good Samaritan. Well, who is my neighbor? What about the one you live with? In 1 Peter chapter 3, I want to just reference a couple of things to the women because I'm an equal opportunity picker on her. 1 Peter chapter 3, this does talk about submission. The problem is we don't understand what submission means. It does not mean doormat. It does not mean helpless, hopeless. It does not mean you have no personality, you have no thought process. It does not mean that you are a nobody. But it's a dirty word in our society. People don't like to hear the word submit because that means you're weak. The discussion is to women, accept the way God things made it. except that there is headship. Now it's on his shoulders and his responsibilities to use that headship appropriately. He will be held accountable. But the reality is, remember, if it's not about happiness but holiness, it doesn't matter, except for the asterisk, how he behaves. It's how do you respond. And that you are told, ladies, so that even if you're married to someone who doesn't obey the word, an unbeliever, it says, they may be won over without a word. You don't even have to say a word. Your behavior should be able to win them over. Now, what would it be like if you're married to a believer who has a Holy Spirit? It doesn't say, therefore, open your mouth and nag him to death. It says, what you could accomplish indirectly by your conduct, by your attitude. And he even goes on to say, don't adorn yourselves outwardly by braiding your hair and by wearing gold ornaments or fine clothing. And that he's not saying don't wear jewelry. He's talking about your attitude. If you're not, who cares about how pretty you are on the outside? It's what are you like inside? And he says, rather let your adornment be the inner self with the lasting beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in God's sight. Do you believe that, ladies? Do you believe that that is what he's looking at, your heart and your attitude, because you want to be holy? And yeah, you married that cretin and you're stuck with him, and he's not in the asterisk category, so I'm just going to tough it out and I'm going to become holy. That's the reality. Verse 7, though, husbands, in the same way, with the same attitude, it's all about what's on the inside, he says, show consideration for your wives and your life together, paying honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they too are also heirs of the gracious gift of life. They have the same reward you're going to get. They have the same calling that you have. They have the same status in the eyes of the Father. They are children of the Most High. And he says, you better live with them that way, man, but you can accept the fact that they are women. But oh, by the way, guys, if you don't treat them with honor that they deserve, being a daughter of the Most High, of being your spouse, of being a separate creation, oh, by the way, if you don't do that, the inference is your prayers are hindered. So that nothing may hinder your prayer. So, you know, there are a lot of guys, and I've said this before, that think because they can be the big macho guy, the dictator in the house, the alpha male or whatever it is, and they're going to run the show, and that woman is going to do what they says, and the kid, they're all about authority. But there's no honor. There's no value. It's just like in Malachi 2 when they're praying, and they're saying, well, why isn't he answering me? My experience has been that far more women that I've met are what I'll call prayer warriors. And their prayers are heard, and I believe their prayers are answered. And so when I need prayer help, I'll ask my buddies, but I go track down some women that I know are faithful and constant in prayer. And I live with one. And if I can't get her to pray for me, I'm in real trouble. Well, I mean, it's reality. Why? We're even supposed to pray for our enemies, so at least I can lay that card on the table to her. You got to do it. No matter how you feel about me today, you got to do it. But I think a lot of men within the churches, the various branches of the family, don't follow that and don't believe that verse. They think they can treat their wife as a second-class citizen. And they can pray to God, and they can be diligent, and they can be faithful. And God is saying, hello? Your prayers are hindered. There are times when it doesn't go too far beyond the ceiling, I'm sure. Let me keep moving here. Let's go to 1 John chapter 2 to wrap up. 1 John chapter 2. Continuing this theme, in verse 9 it says, whoever says, I am in the light, whoever has the Spirit, has the Son living in him, whoever is in the light, while hating a brother or sister, is still in the darkness. Whoever loves a brother or sister lives in the light, and such a person there is no cause for stumbling. So it says, love is a characteristic of whether you're in the darkness or whether you're in the light. And if you claim to have a relationship with the Father and yet you don't love a brother or sister, says you're really in darkness, because it is love, which God is love, which defines us. Remember 1 John, or John 15, verses 33 and 34, by this shall all men know you are my disciples, by the love that you have. That's the mark. It's not what you wear. It's not what you say. It's not what you eat. It's not what day you keep. All of those being placed in the context of you got to do what you know you should do. But he says it's love that is going to define whether you're my disciple, whether you're really a follower. Let's go to chapter 3, verse 16. In this context of our spouses, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our spouse. It says for one another. But that goes back to Ephesians 5. Remember we read that he gave himself for the church, that she might be set aside as holy and distinct and separate? Right here. We know love by this. It's sacrificial. It's giving. It's being willing to sacrifice yourself. He uses for one another, and I'm saying, no, he means for your spouse if you're married. And for other people you come in contact with. But it is all about, are we willing to be sacrificial? Are we willing to give? How far are we willing to give? He gave till there was no more life left in him. Let's go to chapter 4, verse 7. Beloved. John is telling us who we are. Beloved. We are beloved by the Father. We are beloved by the Son. We are beloved because he died for us. He cared that much about us. He said, let us love one another. Let us love our spouse, okay? Because love is from God. Everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. And in case we don't understand, in verse 8 he says, whoever does not love does not know God, for God is love. That's pretty black and white. If you're not loving, you don't know God. I mean, that's what my version says, and I don't think it's a bad translation. For God is love, if we're going to reflect him. Verse 9, God's love was revealed to us among us in this way. God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. And this is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the atoning sacrifice for our sins. Beloved, since God loved us so much, we also ought to love one another. In verse 12, no one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is perfected in us. If we love one another, if you love your spouse. I'm going to stop right here and make a very shameless promotion for our seminar this afternoon. At 4:30, Sharon and I are going to cover 10 fundamental needs that each couple has, that if we fulfill those needs, the love will be there. I'd like to go on, but I want you to come, so I'll tell you then what we're going to cover. But we're going to cover His needs and her needs. And that's how you help develop the love that we keep reading about. But the love that we keep reading about is not necessarily the love that you're just smitten when you see the movies. It's sacrificial love, that what can I do for you? We hear that in the wedding ceremony, I do's. The next day it should be, what can I do for you? Not, what are you going to do for me today? What can I do for you? Let's keep going on, wrapping it up here. Verse 18, I want to jump down to verse 18. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, for fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. Remember I talked about Adam and Eve and that they were naked and unashamed? A lot of times we're afraid within a marriage to be ourselves. We're afraid if we're vulnerable, it'll be used as a tool against us. We're afraid that if we're open and let them know what our needs are, that they will deny that and they will reject us. If they really knew who I was, if my spouse really knew what I thought about this, maybe she wouldn't love me anymore. If my spouse really, and you can go through and add all these things, because it's all based out of a spirit of fear. But in Timothy, we're told, you have not been given a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of sound mind. If we're confident in the fact that the Messiah was willing to die for me and that I am a child made in the likeness and image of God, then we should not be afraid to grow and develop in the openness, in the vulnerability, in the commitment that we need. We should not be afraid. But it's a process. And finally, verse 20. Those who say, I love God and hate their brothers or sisters are liars. For those who do not love a brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. And then I hear people say, yeah, but you aren't married to my husband or wife, or you don't know this person like I know them. Do you see any qualifiers in there? It says only if they exceed your standards you can love them. It says, really, this is pretty scary. Those who say I love Yahweh, those who say I love Jesus, those who say whatever name you want to put in there and do not love their brothers or sisters are liars. Where do you think our spouse fits in? Because if we can't love the person that we committed and covenanted with till death do us part, he's saying the truth is, how can you love a God you've not seen? If you can't do that, you can't do this. I'm just telling you, you're a liar. You're deceived. And you know what? You're going to have a big surprise. Because again, I go back in wrapping up. These verses reveal who we are, not who my spouse is. Sharon heard an interesting thing by Emerson Eggerich the other day, that he says that external forces reveal who we really are. And his example was, think of butter and clay. And if it's about 50 degrees, you have this lump of cold, wet clay, and you have this block of sort of cold, hard butter. But when the sun comes out and the heat starts increasing and the pressure and the heat, clay hardens. And we build buildings out of clay. Because it changes to a state when it's got that sun on it. And it reveals that if you put sunlight and heat on clay, it's a really strong building material. But if you put sunlight and heat on butter, it becomes a puddle of nothing. And it's not until an external force comes around that reveals what it really is. And it goes back to, as it were, the liquid form. It came from cream. It goes back to the way it started. So when we look at marriage, when we look at our relationships, when we look at Scripture, and we have issues within our family or with our spouse, it doesn't reveal who they are. It reveals who we are. And how are we going to respond? And God says, if you want to be holy, then you're going to do it one way. And if you want to be happy, you think you're going to go find somebody else to be happy with. And it doesn't work. Statistically, second marriages 60% fail. Third marriages 80% fail. And all these people realize, if I would have just learned these lessons on my first one, I could have stayed in something that God intended to be permanent. So to conclude, brethren, marriage is an institution from the beginning. It is intended to help us picture the relationship that our Messiah has with us. Yes, it's a mystery, but he said the more you understand the marriage relationship and the oneness, that what happens to one affects the other, if you get close to your Savior and something happens to you, don't you think he's aware of it and it's affecting him? And do we realize that when we sin, when we fall down, when we turn our back on him, when we blame him, when we accuse him, that it affects him? Also, point two is that marriage is intended to be permanent. Till death do us part. Not till something better comes along, or until, I don't know what happened, but we're incompatible. Got to find somebody else. But ultimately, it is to be filled by love. And this again goes back to the principle that doing loving things create loving feelings. So I appreciate the opportunity to share this with you. It is something that I hope, as the years go by, I will learn more and more and more. But I think there's so much in here about our responsibilities with marriage and how it is something that God started at the beginning, and he said it was good. And I hope the day is coming, and you can stay there, where you can say to your spouse, in all of your splendid nakedness, that you can stand there and say, I'm open, I'm vulnerable, and we are one, and there is nothing hidden. And you would not be ashamed for who you are, because you are being created and transformed and changed into the image of his Son. And it's pretty cool, I'm sure, in heaven when they sit down and say, look what the kids are doing. Look, they're starting to look like us. This is pretty cool. Maybe we can say, let's stop this thing and send you back, so that day is coming. And until that day comes, I think if we spent more time and more effort, more thought, more prayer, and more sacrifice in our marriages, you would be amazed what our families will look like, what our fellowships will look like, and even what our communities would look like. Thank you. It is also our tradition in our fellowship that speakers can't just say, I'm done, and walk away. We open it up to any comments, so that the intent was, if it's related to the message, we're glad to hear it. We don't want you to go off on some rabbit hole. But it's also to correct error. So I'm just saying that for our visitors, that until you say I can sit down, I got to stand here. So it depends on how long you want to wait till you eat. There you go. Aaron's got a mic in case anybody's got a thought or a question or a challenge. I see they want to eat, Aaron. Let's sing. Oh, Fred, there you go. You had too big of a lunch, I can tell.
Hello. I want to say, first of all, God loves you. I hope he loves me, too. But yes, I do. I know he loves me. But anyhow, my wife, we've been married for 43 years. Mm-hmm. And whenever anything happens, I says, hey, it's in the contract. And that finishes it. But anyhow, I love you too, Jeff. Okay, you guys have a great day. Have a wonderful meal. And God bless you all.
You know that baby's hot?
Why don't you give it to Aaron? Okay, why don't we sing a final song or two, and then we're going to need help when we're done to set up tables and stuff. And hopefully, if you can, stick around till 4:30, and I'll tell you those 10 things.
There was an announcement that somebody wanted passed on. The Church of God International congregation down in Southfield on the first weekend in August, I believe it's the 2nd and 3rd, is having their Infuse weekend, which is where they invite in youth. If there's anybody here that would be interested in knowing more about that, come see me. I can put you in touch with the right people, but they wanted to at least get the word out that that's going to take place on that weekend. And then after the closing prayer, we would like help if you can take your belongings and move them out of this room. And then those of you that are able, maybe help us with some tables and chairs.
So if you all rise, we're going to go ahead and finish up today with some praise songs.